So I'm going to begin tonight. I'm going to move into the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which could take a bit of time. So I'm going to offer a little bit of an overview about the fourth foundation of mindfulness and how we might be able to actually practice it. And it'll probably take me several weeks to get through the teachings because they're quite, there's quite a lot. So when we look at just a review here, the mindfulness, of course, is the big word. You know, we hear so much about mindfulness in so many different ways, and so much of the messages and so much of the teaching we get on mindfulness is actually fairly inaccurate to its original source. In fact, there's some evidence to suggest that the original source is a bit corrupt in and of itself. So there's all these problems when you have these teachings that come down over these years. Shut this thing off. So Satipatthana, sati meaning like to remember, to recognize, tana meaning a ground or a foundation. So the Buddha's trying to get us to remember, to recognize a grounding of experience. So of course he starts with the body, because the body is very grounding, and the feelings and the mental states, I've talked about that a lot. I'll try to get those recordings up for you soon. I'm sorry I haven't already. And then he talks about the fourth foundation of mindfulness was, oh, Anne was last week. Oh, was Anne good? She's good, right? Yeah, good. I'm glad she wanted to get a report. Yeah, she's awesome. She's one of my favorites. I appreciate it. I had strep throat last week, also known as swallowing razor blades, which, so I'm much better now. So for years and years and years, I actually didn't teach the fourth foundation of mindfulness because I didn't feel as though I could do so adequately. In fact, me and my teaching partner, Cheryl Sleen, have taught many, we've probably taught 10 retreats together, and neither of us have really dipped into this so much. I did a little bit this year at Vallecitos, because it's always been so confusing to me. So let's just get into what they might be talking about in the fourth foundation. Because remember, we've gone from the body to feelings to mind, like where's the next level up? And so in Satipatthana, it's called mindfulness of dhammas or dharmas, same word, dharma, dhamma. And so the question becomes, well, what does dharma mean in the context of the fourth foundation of mindfulness? Sometimes it's called mind objects, which I think is a useless translation. Mental activities, maybe a bit better. The Abhidharma would say the smallest unit of discernible experience, if you can wrap your head around what that might mean. And then I think actually the thing that's sort of funny all these years, I think what they mean by dharma is the teachings. As we all know, the Buddha taught the dharma. So when we're being mindfulness of the fourth foundation, they're saying, be mindful of the teachings, be mindful of cause and effect, be mindful of unwholesome mental states, be mindful of constructive mental states. There's lots of teachings one could be mindful of. Right. And so to some degree, I think there's no way around it. I think the fourth foundation of mindfulness is encouraging us to take a kind of philosophical stance on how we experience the world. Or perhaps a philosophical stance on how we experience the world and then what we might be able to do about that. So it's a practical philosophy. It's not philosophy for the sake of just entertaining our intellection. So part of the fourth foundation of mindfulness would be this word intellectual, but the word, the function of mind is called intellection, which is concepts and ideas and reason and thinking about things and ethics and should I do this and should I do that. It's a big fourth foundation of mindfulness. It's a huge neighborhood, okay? A lot going on. It's really the content of our cognition. What's going on? What's going on in the mind that's meditating? And so I want to just kind of start by giving the vast perspective on this. So we can kind of, so the first thing that we need to be able to do to even begin to do a practice like the fourth foundation of mindfulness, and many of you are probably there, but we need to be able to have some awareness and some recognition of, I would say, the mind as a mental event. So when you break down experience moment to moment, basically what the Buddha is saying is that the mind is a series of episodes kind of linked together. And those series of episodes linked together is what you call your life. Right. And so we need to be able to witness the mind as a mental event. So what does that mean? So a mental event could be like, you know, I'm hungry and I want to make a sandwich. That could be a kind of mental event. It's kind of the narration of what's going on in the world of thinking. Is probably really the most colloquial, easy way to understand it, is it's a kind of mindfulness and awareness of thinking itself as a psychological event, not as me being a person having thoughts. That's not what we're getting at here. But the mind experiencing the creation of concepts and words and ideas and all this kind of stuff, which you can do, and I'm sure you've seen this before. You can literally watch the mind with the mind. It's what they would call in neuroscience metacognitive awareness, metacognition, which is actually, I think, a good word. Meta meaning multiple. And when you watch your mind, one thing that you notice is there's all kinds of shit going on. You know, there's events upon events upon events upon events. And so what the problem with people, as the Buddha points out, is that we buy that whole mental event hook, line, and sinker. So we assume that what's happening in our mind is also that which is happening in the world. All right. So this is really gets kind of complicated because most people, so I think of the mind sometimes, this kind of aspect of mind, as kind of like your social media news feed. Just the mind is just a scrolling endless news feed of what the Dave Smith individual could be doing or not doing or should be doing or should probably do. It's just on and on. It doesn't have a bottom. There's no bottom to the news feed. And the problem is, mostly what I'm doing is I'm believing the information and the data that's in that feed. And the Buddha's saying you absolutely should not do that. You know, your mind is not always giving you trustworthy data or information. Right. So part of it is, you know, trying to have a kind of relationship to that. What is my relationship to my thinking? Now, the one thing that I can say that's maybe more practical, because it's so hard for this conversation not to get too heady. It's just impossible. I've tried it. I don't think it can be done. But one thing I'll say that might give you a little more practicality is that thinking gets a very bad reputation in meditation culture. I think you all know that. So if I'm practicing mindfulness, if I'm doing any forms of meditation and any thinking is happening, then I'm somehow fucking up. I'm not doing it correctly, which is just such a, if you're going to break one idea in your mind about meditation, that's the one to break, because that's not true. The one thing I can say wholeheartedly that I can say is a result of long-term practice that I greatly appreciate and value so much is that the quality of my thought life, my thinking world life, is so much better than it used to be. In fact, my mind, my thinking mind doesn't even really bother me hardly at all anymore. I don't even like, I'm totally, we're cool. Me and the mind, I know it's doing stupid shit all the time. I know what it's up to. I'm on to its game. It rarely bothers me. Of course, for me, it's emotions that get me in trouble. It's the emotional part of my experience that is where the heart of my work lies. But as far as my mind and my thinking, totally, totally no problem. Because I've been able to, and so even the wandering bits of my mind, I don't really get caught up in habit loops around resentment or trying to fix or change or control or blame or judge or criticize. I don't do much of that anymore, to be honest with you. Mostly, I in the four foundations of mindfulness, I have my body, I have my feelings, my mental states, and my thinking all happening and arising all together. And I can kind of move through that space with really quite a bit of ease. So to some degree, it's the long-term game is not ending or getting rid of thinking, but ultimately changing our relationship to our thinking mind. Right? Because one of the things that happens, and this probably happens to you, is we sometimes feel bad about the shit that arises in your mind. You're like, I'm a bad person for having this thought. I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about. we can take the contents of the mind very personally. And we also have to remember that what your the non-volitional thoughts that just kind of appear in the mind are in no way a reflection of you as a person, especially in terms of value or worth. Right? The mind comes up with so much terrible shit that thinking bad about the terrible shit that it came up with is like, you got to get that one under control. It's not your fault. You didn't do it. It arose. Because if we're really honest, much of our thoughts throughout the day are actually pretty terrible. I some of the stuff that I'm just like, sometimes I just go, wow, really? Still? Like, you know, like I'm going to run this motherfucker off the road. You know what I mean? Like, I I'm going to kill this person right now. Like, you know, and it's like, really? Or this person should not even be here. You know, like we think some really, and maybe it's just me. I don't think it is. But that's not really anything to do anything except for maybe have a good chuckle. Right. And so we have to, and this is where, so like, if you look at like the quote that gets so much airtime in mindfulness, Viktor Frankl, the great Viktor Frankl's quote of between stimulus and response, there's a gap. And in that gap lies our freedom and our power to choose. So what we actually create in the fourth foundation is by paying more attention to the body and the feelings and the mental states and the cognition, the content of the thinking mind, we kind of grow this space, kind of like a window of tolerance, a window of space where we can kind of be, where we can, in mindfulness, can kind of be there. And it can look up at it, it can pop up there, but it doesn't live there. You know, and I'm sure you've all been there. When you live in the world of your thinking mind, for most people, it's a nightmare. Like, I think about this, and I have conversations with people sometimes who are really struggling. Like, I think we can have a lot of compassion. I think there's a lot of people in our world, in our society, in our culture, whose minds are a fucking horror movie. Moment to moment, just suffering, identification. I think a lot of people live in a mind that most of us would deem totally excruciating. And some of you have probably lived in a mind like that at times. And some of you have probably been there. I certainly have been there, which is why one of the things that you probably heard me tell the story many times, but one of the things, the Dharma intervention that I had, the greatest, most insight, most meaningful epiphany, whatever you want to call it, big epic moment I ever had in practice was the very first one. And I have ever yet to have one even close to that since. And that was when I was 18 years old and I lived in this horror movie mind. I lived in this highly traumatic stress mind, totally meaningless universe mind, world is a horrible place mind, what's it all for mind. I'm not suicidal, but I fucking kind of wish that I was. Just hating on all of it. It's all bad and wrong. And somehow I think it actually all might even be my fault. And there's definitely no God. And if there is, he certainly doesn't like me very much. And all of that. And then, you know, I learned mindfulness, you know, from Stephen Smith. He kind of gave me this whole dissertation, this whole Buddhist Dharma talk on this kind of stuff, which helped. And I'll never forget sitting in the hall at IMS. The 3-month retreat had just ended. IMS, they were like cleaning it out. And I sat across from him and he told me to put my attention on my breathing and hold it there. And that when my mind would wander, to just notice that and then come back to my breathing. You know the drill. And after like 5 minutes, I was like, holy fucking fuck. That's like a thing. That's a thing that's happening. And there's other things that are actually happening. Like I got a glimpse into that window. There's some place my mind can be that's actually okay. Like there's a setting that doesn't actually suck. right? There's and it's all these things we talk about. It's mindfulness, it's the Dharma, it's equanimity, it's Nibbana, it's the deathless, it's all these terms we talk about. But there is this available space in the mind that's quiet and excellent, not confined by thought, doesn't come to through logic or reason. It's an experiential intelligence is really the only way to talk about it. Is that now I'm realizing that I can be intelligent about my experience. And yes, I have this whole shit show going on up here, but that is just actually a charade. You know, and I got a massive, massive taste of that. My life has never been the same since. I basically like was reborn in that moment, dare I use that kind of word. Like I never was that bad ever again for me, ever. Like I was out. I was like let out of prison. Now, did my life continue to be challenging? Yes, but at least I felt like I had a fighting chance now. I was like, okay, well, if this is what's going on, maybe something can be done. You know, and I would imagine if you're here on this call and you're in this group and you're doing this stuff, you know what I'm talking about, at least on some level, or you wouldn't bother with any of this bullshit. Because this is hard. But when I look at the alternative, you know, I know that that's, and so that's a lot of that is just the raining down of the fourth foundation of mindfulness and kind of a horrible sense. Now, not everybody has that. And this is why I also think Dharma practice is not for everybody. You know, I don't think this is the only way people find meaningful experiences in their life. I think there's lots of different ways people cultivate meaningful, happy lives. This is just one of them. But I think for those of us who have had tasted the rancid horribleness of what the mind can be like, we really feel courageous and we feel inspired to say, well, I'm going to cultivate something different. And then once you get into that position, then the Dharma just becomes very obviously the thing to be doing. Right. And then that just kind of becomes maybe how we live. And it becomes maybe a map of sorts or some kind of guide, some kind of direction that guides away from that kind of mind into these other spaces. So that's kind of, so there's like this, I think mind like foundation 3.5, where we can kind of start, where we're not being dictated by greed, hatred, and confusion in the lower side of the third foundation. And we're not being projected up into the hindrances, into the kind of doomscape of the world. There's this kind of sweet spot that I think the Buddha calls Nibbana. And I think that what we it's like almost like, I think it's like a frequency of mind that we kind of need to dial that in. And it reminds me, you remember when your radio in the car had like buttons and dials that you had to like turn the dial? And every once in a while you'd be driving and there'd be like a radio station you liked. But the only fucking way to get the radio station to work is you had to keep your hand on the dial and slowly be turning it left and right the entire time. Did you ever do that? Remember that? Yeah. And you get tired of it, and then the driver would have to do it, and you take turns turning the radio. I think that's the effort of the Dharma, is we always have to be trying to dial that thing in. There's no setting. And right to the left and right to the right of that frequency is total fucking chaos. How far left do you have to go on the dial before you get the white noise? Not very far. Not a lot of bandwidth. In fact, really, in the reality, and this is the dukkha aspect of the analogy, is the radio station actually never is clear ever. There's always a little bit of static in there, right? There's always a little bit of like wanting, you know what it could sound like if only that static wasn't there. And that's that dukkha. So even in the Nibbanic frequency of psychological freedom or liberation, whatever you want to call it, there's still dukkha there. There's still something about the whole goddamn endeavor that seems a bit harder than it should be. Right? You know what I mean? So we find that basically like when we're being bombarded by thoughts, there's sort of three categories to think about it. There's psychological, there's thinking, let's just use that word. There's thinking that is hindering me from being happy. There's thinking that's blocking me from the path. There's thinking that's obstructive. It's destructive. It's unskillful. It doesn't go anywhere. And we'll talk about this next week. Buddha calls them hindrances. And defilements, all these different terms. It's not that they cause suffering so much, but they're blocking me. It's too far to the left. It's just a little too much static, right? There's that kind of thinking. Then there's this other kind of thinking that is open, spacious, kind, curious, friendly, the awakening factors, courageous, awareness, contentment, equanimity, joy. There's thinking that kind of has that to it. And that's the kind of thinking mind, that's the kind of psychology, the kind of cognition that we want to cultivate. Right? So the mind, of course, is a whirlwind. It's going so fast, it's hard to notice. So what we want to do slowly over time is to start getting a felt sense of the kind of thinking that leads us in a direction that's hopeful and skillful. And we want to abandon that, and we want to cultivate that, and we want to abandon this other kind of thinking. And that's a lot of the work that we do here. And I can tell you, and as I've said, I can assure you that slowly over time, that paradigm will improve and that will shift dramatically. Where you'll be less concerned about yourself and less concerned about the world and more interested in the interplay between the two. How can I be in this world differently? Because most people think happiness is about me getting the things that I want from the world. Okay, what's the world got, you know? Ask not what the world can do for you, but what you can do for the world. You know, that kind of thinking. And so we break free from that. We recognize and we understand the flawed strategy that even if you got what you wanted from the world, you wouldn't be fucking happy anyway. So even if you win, you lose. Right? So that's not really the thing. We're not trying to get what I want from the world. And I'm also not trying to be a renunciant or an aesthetic where like the world is just a big failure and bad and wrong and I'm going to retreat from it. There's a kind of relationship that we need to begin to develop, which really to me is the Dharma practice is really about having an intelligent relationship to your experience. Not to yourself, not to the world, but this word, I really like this word experience, right? That's the primary relationship that we have with people think the primary relationship we have is the one we have with ourselves, but I don't think that's quite right. My primary, most fundamental relationship is the relationship that I have with my experience. And part of that experience is a sense of self, for sure. But that's really what we're after. And so that is a non-binary experience. It's not, there's no good and bad and right and wrong and self and other, all that stuff isn't factored in. There's just kind of this awareness of what's arising in the mind. And the question is, do I want to abandon this quality that's arising? I got greed in my mind. I got envy and jealousy in my mind. Do I want to entertain that? Or do I want to do something else? And so a lot of this is our aspects of what we would call the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And so a lot of people, I think Dharma teachers generally don't talk about it, A, because they don't actually understand it, which was the case with me. They talk about it nervously because they're a little bit unsure. And they avoid talking about it because I don't know how much sense I'm making. It's a really complicated thing to actually talk about, right? But I would gather that you're picking up bits and pieces of it where you're like, okay, I see that, I see this, I see that. And so it's very important that we have some kind of way of experiencing it. Like, okay, this is, so knowing where things reside. So like, so just to give you an example, like if there's unpleasantness in the second foundation of mindfulness, unpleasantness, then there's really likely to be hatred in the third foundation of mindfulness, which means there's very likely to be aversion in the fourth. So they're all connected together. So if I'm feeling unpleasant, I'm wanting to get rid of that, and then I start thinking about how I'm going to get rid of that. So this is why having awareness of the other foundations is good, because these things they typically have a kind of causal chain. They're dependent upon something. So like, for example, aversion is dependent upon me having an unpleasant experience. Right. If I'm not having an unpleasant experience, then aversion won't arise in my mind, because it needs the condition of unpleasantness for it to emerge. Right. This is why the Buddha is so keen on getting us to change our relationship to feeling tones, because he's like, if you don't change your relationship to feeling tones, if you can't be with discomfort, you're going to be caught up in hatred and frustrated and aversion all the time. Right. And if you back up the 12 links of dependent origination, we have contact, feeling, and then craving. Contact, feeling, and reactivity. And the problem is we react to our feelings because we're unaware of them and the power they have to dictate thinking, behavior, intentions, so forth. So, you know, we start to kind of have a ability to have a kind of detection, a kind of monitoring of one system. You know, because the whole system is connected and so interdependent upon it, that mindfulness is in its fullest capacity. The fullness of mindfulness is we're kind of monitoring the feelings and the Vedana and the Chitta and the mental states. And we're kind of, we get good at monitoring the whole system all the time, so that if there's something that arises that's destructive, we can dismantle it, you know, as quickly and as effectively as possible. Whether and that could be maybe in the Vedana system, or you know, it doesn't matter where you cut it off. And so this is great, because the Buddha is kind of giving you a diagnostic manual. You know, that's really what the Satipatthana Sutta is. It's a diagnostic manual as to how the organism behaves in and of itself. Which is great, because there's a lot of forgiveness in that. It's totally not your fault. The operating system is not your fault. And in any ways your operating system has been tinkered with or fucked with, or that's also not your fault. I mean, the operating system is bad enough in and of itself. Then you throw in some trauma, and you know, you throw in some adverse life experiences, and the system gets really wonky. Not your fault. Okay. But the question becomes, what can we do? What kind of an intervention? How can we change the relationship so the system runs as optimal as possible? And this is totally and completely doable. This is not magic. This is not esoteric. This is definitely not mystical in any way, shape, or form. This is just something that can simply be done. And I would say, and we'll get there in weeks to come, but this is where the path ends. This is where the path concludes in the teachings of right concentration, as they're poorly translated, is about integration. So when I've developed the Eightfold Path and I'm using these eight branches of ethics and training in mindfulness, what I'm doing is I'm learning how to optimize the system so it performs as best as it can. It's not about being perfect. It's not about being right or being good or any of that. It's just about trying to optimize performance of your system through your speech, through your actions, through your views, through your intentions. Right? We want the system to run as best as it can. And from a systems view, I think that's really kind of really that's really what the Buddha is interested in. And maybe only thing he's interested in is for you to learn how to optimize and how to navigate the lived system as best as one can, right? And that to me, that I like this thinking, because there's nothing mystical at all about it. It's just, you know, it's just constant work. That's the thing about it. That's a bit of a drag. You know, it's like an old muscle car. Like every time you drive the thing, you got to readjust the carburetor and fix the, you know, the idle, and you know, it always needs to be tinkered with. You know, there aren't we're not Teslas, okay? We're like 1970s fucking Pontiacs at best. And even when the Pontiac runs great, it's still a little bit of a piece of shit, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's okay, you know. So let's do some practice for a little bit, and then we'll have a chance for some discussion on this.